My name is Stephanie. I'm Australian and I live in the Netherlands now for 5 years. And yeah, so I started out blogging just about general life in Holland, and now I talk about other things in my life. The one about the shit train I've been riding. Don't expect a lot of positivity in this post. It's hard keeping your shit together at times. For almost 3 years, I've been keeping my head together about this whole situation with the monsters. One hurdle after another, and to be honest, yes, I have glossed over a lot more of the serious nature of our situation and covered it with a lot of humour.
We were monitoring and wait and see and living from one day to the next. That's what I remember actually most, and every day we won was a bonus.
I wonder how I retained my sanity. I really honestly do, because when I look back at some of the things that happened, and there's such an emotional ups and downs and milestones and setbacks, and I think, you know, I really kind of get to the point where I'm like, how did I keep it all together?
Hello, dear podcast listeners. This is a special edition, a longer story. It started when I got a Facebook message. The message read, "I have a warm place in my heart for Leiden. The LUMC saved my daughter's lives. Now Leiden is where I live in the Netherlands, and the LUMC is the Leiden University Medical Center. A message like this, well, it kind of sets things in motion. A flurry of Facebook Messenger activity follows, and a number of moving interviews are recorded. The story about to unfold is about the desire to have children and the fear of losing them. It's about a rare variation of an already rare condition known as TTTS, twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. It can be a death sentence and brings joyous, expectant parents to the edge of despair." Stephanie is an Australian and a blogger with a great sense of humour. This is a post she wrote about a breakup with her supermarket. Yes, I said supermarket.
Things have been good between us, haven't they? You've had a loyal customer who loves your home deliveries and looks forward to the monthly delivery of all the stuff I can't be bothered lifting or carrying home. I've had some good service, and who can complain when you send around that really good-looking delivery driver who drops his load right in the kitchen and smiles at you as he asks you to put in your PIN. I have to admit, though, my attentions have been straying. Things are getting expensive, and I've been forced around to look at other options. And then today, I cheated on you. I discovered someone else who delivers to my door.
Stephanie loves life.
I write a drinking game every year that's requested by friends in Australia.
She writes about everything on her blog.
Absolutely slam it. And it's really,
but it's not all wordplays and saucy jokes. The tone changes when it comes to the ordeal that she's been through with her daughters.
The one about why I haven't had a post recently. I'd like to say it was because I have been busy. Well, it's sort of part of the reason. We've dealt with chickenpox, family trips to Germany, a solo weekend for me, and a lot of just general business. I've also been battling some personal demons. I realise that I'm pretty open on this blog, and it does leave me open to criticisms and judgments.
So what happened?
I'd like to say...
To really understand Stephanie's story, we need to go back.
So my name is Marius Ernst. I was born in the Netherlands, but my parents are German, so I grew up also in the Netherlands. So I have a bit of a dual nationality background.
This is Marius, Stephanie's husband.
We were both involved in some sort of online game.
And, we met 11 years ago playing an online political game, and we actually never set out to have a romance. We were friends, and he mentioned he was coming through Australia, and I was like, oh, yeah, no, look, come stay with me. I'll take you around and things like that. He was a poor university student at the time doing his PhD. And so, yeah, and then things gradually progressed from there. And then about 6 years later, we ended up getting married.
Shortly afterwards, they decided to move to the Netherlands. First impressions are somewhat strange.
I come from tropical Queensland, and to come here and it's raining every day. But not only that, when I first moved to the Netherlands, we also lived in a very small apartment in the middle of the city. And so I arrived on April 4th. We had Queen's Day, then we had Bevrijdingsdag, and then straight after that, we had the World Cup or the European Cup football championships. So there were stages on both sides of us with music pretty much 24/7.
And the party just seems to continue, and it goes on and on.
Orange flags everywhere. So I literally arrived in the middle of the orange fever, and it didn't stop.
Eventually things do calm down, and the couple starts to think about having kids.
We actually sort of decided early on that we would see what comes along, and that's what we actually just went with the flow. We kind of said, yeah, maybe one kid, maybe two kids. We'll see how we feel after the first. And yeah, that was kind of like a big learning curve. Oh, well, we fell pregnant pretty much straight away, and unfortunately 9 weeks later, after I was in Australia for a holiday, we lost the first baby. And there was not really anything we could do. It was just one of those cases that it wasn't to be. It was really tough because I was away from, at that point in time, my husband was in China for work. I was in Australia, so we weren't even in the house together. I had to call him in China to tell him that we'd lost the baby. And it was a fairly traumatic experience because it was I was bleeding, and they told me I'd lost the baby, and that was hard. But then kind of there was a few things that happened afterwards, like getting sent to the wrong clinic, and then I did write about it, and it was just, it did take a while for it actually to come out that I'd spoken about, that we'd had a miscarriage, because again, the stigma that society has, and you don't know whether to talk about it, and it is difficult when you lose a baby to actually sort of find out, to talk about it, especially because if it's in the early stages, a lot of people go, yeah, but it wasn't a real baby, but it's the expectation that's behind it. It's still very raw, and when I get to, because the due date of the child was 1st of February, when I get to that day, it's really quite difficult to come across and say, to think about, I would have a four-year-old, I would have or a five-year-old, I would have a child at school. And that can be quite difficult when you come across that thought, when you come across those thoughts on those days. So, but yeah, it can be difficult.
Slowly things got back to normal. But little did the couple know that their lives were about to be turned upside down again.
It was actually a year later. So it was around, I'll tell the funny story. We tell people every year when they're watching Eurovision, do not drink and watch Chadwick. Here she comes, shot him fast, bad, shot him fast, too late. That's all we have to because that's how you end up with twins. Jedward, yes, we're huge Eurovision fans in this house. It's one of the many reasons we stay married, because we both love sitting down and watching Eurovision and getting and really trashing it.
Stephanie tells the story of when she first heard she was having twins.
So we went to the ultrasound for 10 weeks, and I was lying there, and I was sitting in the waiting room, and Marius was running late, and he was only 10 minutes late. But by the time he got from the car park to the hospital, I was a sobbing hysterical mess, because it was just all coming up, and I was so, it was so raw, and I was just like, this is the moment that we lost the last one. Everything's going to go wrong. And so we went into the room together, and he was lying there, and they did the scan, and the woman said to me, look, oh, she's kind of digging around, and I'm waiting for the worst. And she goes, oh, they told you that you're having a baby. And I'm like, oh God, it's like a tumor or something like this. You know, all these horrible thoughts are going through my head. And in the meantime, Marius is sitting over in the corner and he's laughing.
And I saw already going back and forth a little bit. So I had already a kind of feeling what was going on. Stephanie had no idea.
Because he saw the look on my face. He'd worked out what's going on. And I'm kind of like, why is he laughing? Why is she doing this? And she goes, well, you know, here it is. And there was this little figure. And then she goes, and here's the other one. Congratulations, you're having twins. And I literally sat up on the bed, which any female listeners will know that if you are having an internal ultrasound, it's really not advisable to do. So I sat up on the bed and I said to her, okay, you have to be shitting me. And she said, no, I'm not joking. It's twins. And I was like, twins. There's two. And poor Marius is in the corner just laughing. So because I'm shocked, and she said, can I get you anything? And I said, it's probably inappropriate to ask for vodka right now.
Apart from terrible morning sickness, things were progressing normally. Then things changed.
Basically, at 23 weeks, I went in for what was a routine ultrasound, and I had my usual ultrasound lady, and I had a different doctor this time, a lovely lady who I saw on the alternate from my regular doctor. And they said to me, the ultrasound technician said, look, something's not right here. I need to go get the doctor because she said, I'm not allowed to diagnose. I need to get the doctor. And I said, oh, that's fine. And I was kind of, what's wrong? And the doctor came in and she looked and she said, look, your twin A has got very little fluid around her and twin B has way too much fluid around her. We think you've developed twin-to-twin transfusion.
Time to introduce an expert.
My name is Enrico Lopriore. I am a pediatrician, a neonatologist, so a specialist in preterm or in babies and sick babies, and I work at the Leiden University Medical Center. I'm head of the Department of Neonatology here in this university center.
So what is twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, or TTTS?
TTTS is a disease that occurs in monochorionic twins. Monochorionic twins means that it's twins that share their placenta. In this situation, one baby, we call this baby the donor, gives too much blood to the other baby. We call that baby the recipient. And this occurs because they are connected with each other through their placenta. They have vascular connections. One baby so gives too much blood to the other one. The other one starts peeing too much because it receives too much blood, and the amniotic fluid of that baby starts expanding very quickly. And if you don't treat that disease, then the woman who's pregnant will deliver much too soon and the babies will die.
It was kind of like you have all the wind knocked out of your sails. It's you're going along, everything's been fine until now, and then all of a sudden you've been given this, it's a death sentence for the twins, because you don't know that it's so unknown, the outcome.
To try and understand the problem, I think of it in terms of plumbing and tubes going across from one baby to the other. There's the placenta in the middle with veins joined across it, and one baby is getting more blood than the other. I ask Dr. Lopriore if my idea of seeing TTTS as a sort of plumbing problem makes sense.
Exactly, much better description. Yeah, it's kind of a plumbing problem. One gets too much water and the other one's not enough, and then if you don't do anything about it, then they get very sick.
Now, the suspected diagnosis has to be confirmed.
It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and that's one thing I remember, the time. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. And I said to my husband, you need to get out of work and we have to go to Leiden. And he said, why Leiden? I said, because they think we have twin-to-twin transfusion and we need to go there for a proper diagnosis.
And I was really quite anxious about this whole pregnant thing because... you hear so many things about medical things that can go wrong or difficult. So I was, about the whole pregnancy, I was quite anxious.
And he went, oh. So he raced out of work, and by 11 o'clock we were on the road to Leiden, and by 12:30 we were sitting in the waiting room at the LOMC. Sorry. I mean, this was how fast everything happened.
Twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome is incredibly rare.
You have dizygotic twins and monozygotic twins. Monozygotic are identical twins. Dizygotic twins are non-identical. So these dizygotic twins, non-identical, always have their own placenta. We call them dichorionic placenta. And these placenta are never connected to each other. So these are safe twins. The other twins, the monozygotic, the identical twins, the majority of them, they occur because one egg of the mother gets fertilized by one sperm, and then suddenly after a couple of days they split into two babies. And these twins very often have a monochorionic placenta, which is one, they share this placenta. These twins, we call monochorionic twins, are the ones that are at risk for all kinds of diseases because of this vascular connection. They occur around 600 to 800 times per year, monochorionic twins in the Netherlands. Only 10% can get this disease, twin transfusion syndrome, but there are more diseases that can occur in these monochorionic twins, such as TAPS, twin anemia, polycythemia sequence, and other diseases. But this is just to explain that the risk group in twins is mainly the identical twins which share their placenta.
We went in for another ultrasound and they said, yeah, twin A is basically stuck to the wall of your uterus because she's just got no fluid, and twin B has got way too much fluid around her. So we need to refer you to a doctor. We got referred to a doctor, and she was quite enthusiastic about laser surgery, which is the treatment for twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. But we were only very, very early stage. Like, they'd only just diagnosed us, and they wanted... There were two options. There was going into a trial program for the twin-to-twin transfusion, the laser surgery, and then there was a watch-and-wait approach. And when we sort of sat there, we went, well, we don't know enough about the risks about the laser surgery. We want to do watch-and-wait. And the doctor actually turned around to us and said... After we'd said we are going to do watch and wait, we're not averse to the laser surgery, but we just want to know what's going to happen. The doctor said you should probably make funeral plans for your babies. And this was the first encounter I had with the LOMC, and I was horrified. I was horrified. I was in tears. I was at the point where I went to the doctor's, to the desk, and I said, I can't have that doctor again. I have to come back in 3 days. You can't give me that doctor again. She just said the most horrible thing to me. And they said, oh. Oh, okay. And then the next appointment I actually got, one of the bigger doctors, and who was extremely fantastic and explained everything really well.
Why do you think the doctor said that?
I really don't know. I think it was more just the fact that it's really a difficult situation, and I think, you know, it's a very tense time when you have the diagnosis. So maybe you take things the wrong way, but also lost in translation. And I've had quite a few lost in translations moments as an expat. You always do. And the whole story of this diagnosis is there is quite a few lost in translation moments. And I think maybe it was just one of those moments, or maybe giving the reality of the situation, because it is something that can kill. And but it was really kind of hard.
It was a difficult time for Stephanie and Marius, but a period of relative stability followed.
Well, yeah, stable was a really good word. And that just means the fluid levels hadn't changed. They could still see the bladders. They could still see the stomachs. The heartbeats were fine. They were checking at this point in time for this unknown condition as well called TAPS, where they were just checking the brain. There's an artery in the brain that they do a check, and they check the blood flow through there. And there was a little discrepancy, but they weren't overly concerned. It was more the fluid levels because of the, at that point in time, it was twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. And so they were really just checking that, and stable was just the mantra. We lived for that word. And it was every 3 days from Almere to Leiden, and just living for that word, stable.
But the stability didn't last.
And I went home that night and I packed a few things and I was like, ah, no, it's okay. Everything's fine. Everything's stable. I came home. I came back to the LOMC the next week to do my regular appointment, and it wasn't my regular ultrasound technician. And I really didn't like it to start with because I didn't particularly connect with him. But when you're going every 3 days to the hospital and you're seeing the same staff, you begin to develop a real relationship with them. And I said to my I said to him, look, I'm really nervous, okay? I just need you to tell me what's going on. So if you see something, just tell me. I'm not going to overreact. Just tell me. And he was like, okay. And he stayed quiet the whole time. And I'm lying there. And at 30 weeks pregnant with twins, not the most comfortable position anyway. And he stopped it all of a sudden. And he said, I need to get my colleague. And I went, okay. So he went out and I was like, okay, I wonder what's going on, kind of thing. I kind of had already figured out there was something wrong, because when you've done 20 or so ultrasounds at this point in time and they're doing the same measurements all the time, you can see that there are differences. And I could see that it's actually called an MCA Doppler, the one on the head. I could see that the MCA Doppler was off the scale for one of the twins. And I was like, yeah, okay, something's going on here. I need to find out. And they brought in my regular ultrasound technician. This is after the guy left a woman who was 30 weeks pregnant, lying flat on her back on a table, not even offering to help her sit up. So it was quite uncomfortable. So I was kind of doing this beached whale impersonation so I could sit up. It felt like forever, because honestly, any woman who's been pregnant will understand when I say, when you're lying down and you're flat on your back, it's really impossible to get up. You can't do it. And so I was desperately sitting up, and they came back in and they found the positions again, and they showed her, and she said, yeah, she said, we think the babies have developed TAPS, but she said, what we also can see is there's a shadow on the brain of twin B. And she said, I personally think it's the position that we're taking it from, but she said, we can't be too careful. So she said, you're not going home.
The good news was that the shadow on the brain wasn't really a shadow and was just due to the position of the scan as thought. The bad news was that the babies had developed TAPS, TAPS, Twin Anemia Polycythemia Sequence. So what is TAPS? Dr. Lopriori explains.
So it's a disease that we discovered or described 10 years ago. We saw sometimes there was one twin that was born that was very red and the other one was very white. And the baby that was white had Blutarmude, anemia. Is that the English? Anemia. And the other one had polycythemia, means too much red blood cells. So twin anemia polycythemia sequence is a disease in which that one baby is anemic and the one is polycythemic. Before we discovered this disease, we thought, oh, well, what probably happened is that during delivery, the baby that was anemic suddenly gave a lot of blood to the other one. That was our interpretation, because before delivery, this baby were looking fine. There was no signs of other kinds of diseases like twin transfusion syndrome. So we thought they're looking fine. They probably don't have any disease. So if they're white and red at birth, they must have, something must have occurred during delivery. But when we looked carefully at their placenta, we found out that they had only very, very tiny connections and only few connections. And we thought these connections were so small, smaller than a millimeter, not even visible with the naked eye almost, that it was physically impossible for a large amount of blood of going from one baby to the other. So we thought this is not something that occurred suddenly during delivery, but it must have occurred previous to the delivery, a chronic disease. And we did a lot of research, and now we found out that it is true, that it's, we know how it's caused, and we're now trying to work on this disease and find out how we can reach the diagnosis, how we can treat this disease. It's a work in progress.
So just how dangerous was this for Stephanie and Marius's babies?
For both fetuses or babies inside the womb, it's a dangerous situation. The baby who is anemic can suffer from the anemia, because if you are very anemic, you become tired, your heart becomes tired, and then you can die because of the severe anemia. The other one, its blood is so sludgy that it can cause infarctions. The blood can clot and cause an infarction in any kind of organs, brains or otherwise.
So this is also life-threatening?
It's certainly life-threatening. It's a different disease than the twin transfusion syndrome, because the twin transfusion syndrome is life-threatening because of the fact that the one who receives more blood starts peeing a lot, and then you get this massive amniotic fluid, and if you don't do anything about, then you can a woman can deliver too soon. In this TAPS disease, there is no difference in amniotic fluid, so there is no sudden increase of production of amniotic fluid. So if you talk it in terms of plumbing, in this TTTS, you have a lot of water going from one side of the other and a sudden expansion of this amniotic fluid. In TAPS, it's very slowly, so there is no difference in water, but there is, at the end, a situation in which one has very severe anemia and the other one has very sludgy blood.
Stephanie is now being monitored constantly. 2 days in hospital have passed, and then...
The room just fills up with people coming from everywhere, and like machines are coming in, and Marius is sort of sitting in the corner going, oh, and I'm like, oh, I think it's happening, you know, I think this is going to happen. And so they started doing, and they're measuring and putting the scanners back on and doing ultrasounds to check the location of the placenta. And so they sort of wheel me off down to the operating theatre, because they put me in the lovely sexy hospital gown. They wheel me off to the operating theatre, and Marius is running along beside me, and it's kind of like, this is all happening so quickly. And you know, they start reading me questions, and then they said to my husband, oh, you need to leave now.
I came with them and went to the surgery room, and I said, no, you can't come in here till here and not any further.
And he was like, I thought I was, no, you need to leave now. So he kind of went out and got a bottle of water, and was looking for a bottle of water, and I was sitting there going, oh, okay, I thought he was going to stay, like, you know. And anyway, the woman said to me, so what operation are you in here for today? And I said, well, I'm actually having a cesarean section to get my twins out. And she went, was that your husband? And I went, yeah, that was. And she goes, oh, we need to find him. So they had about 4 or 5 people looking for him in the cafeteria.
Some other nurse came raving out and say, oh, you're the father. Yeah, okay, come on. And there was a misunderstanding. You can come with us. And then the people at the door of the surgery realized they had made a mistake and didn't realize it was about a delivery. So,
they finally found him just as I was being wheeled in, because he had to scrub as well. So they went and sent him for scrubbing. So they wheeled me in, and lying in this room with all the bright lights, and having an epidural put in, and that was painful. They strap you out and the screen goes up, and it all starts, and I'm kind of like, oh my God, you know, all the time, and my head's just going, this is happening, this is happening. And you hear all this conversation going around you in Dutch, and of course you don't speak that, I didn't speak that much Dutch at the time, so that was kind of overwhelming because you didn't know what was happening, really, and Marius is sort of more focused on not fainting or passing out. And so, yeah, I was just waiting, and, you know, then they said, oh, you're going to feel pressure, and then, like, a pop, and this happens, and they said, okay, first one's out, and it's a girl. And that was all we heard. And then second one, they came, pressure, pop, second one. And, yeah, well, of course, obviously, it was a girl. They're identical twins. But, you know, and this one screamed, but then you're like, why didn't the first one cry?
I can imagine that for a mother, it must be very, very a frightening moment. Because if you hear your baby crying, then you know it's doing well. And when they were delivered through cesarean delivery, and that's when the babies then are then immediately after delivery, they are, we cut the, clamp the cord and they are cut, and then they go to another room where there is a resuscitation table. So it's very complicated for, of very difficult for the mother because they don't hear and see what we are doing. So it must have been a frightening moment for her, I can imagine.
It was so scary and so daunting, and all you're thinking about is this is happening so fast. They really were just in bang, and everything was happening. So
well, they were a very tiny little thing. Emily was very pale and very small, and
Emily was very small. She was very pale. She had not got a lot of nutrients and things like that, so she was really quite underdeveloped, and that she didn't have a lot of muscle or a lot of fat on her body. So we did actually call her the gremlin. We may also have called her the troll doll, but she really was very tiny, and she was only 1.1 kilograms and very pale, which normally newborns are a little bit red, but she was very white and pasty and not very attractive looking, unfortunately, poor child. And Matilda was red. So red she was almost purple. And that was because she had so much blood in her system. She was also very swollen because of the extra blood in her system. So when you put them side by side, there was this really tiny little red white baby and this big, bloated red baby, 1.6 kilograms. But she was mostly all her sister's blood.
Emily was really very, very, very pale, Matilda was extremely red, almost purple, and you actually feel, looking at them, that Emily is the one that is the most acutely in need of help, but actually the other one is struggling even more, because it's even more difficult to pump your blood around if it's so sludgy.
With Emily, she needed blood transfusions, and she was obviously not only there in NICU to feed and grow, but to also develop some fat and some muscle and things like that. And whereas Matilda needed blood taken out of her and her blood thinned down. But as for the rest of it, we didn't know, because there's no real treatments and there's no real solutions at this point in time.
There were on all these monitors, and we didn't know exactly what all the bleeps and things on this monitor went, and when the alarms went off, we didn't know if it was critical or not. After a while, of course, we learned, and we were like, oh yeah, alarm's gone. Oh, it's only that alarm. Oh, no worries. One of the girls just ripped out their oxygen channel again, or something like that.
You have to intervene in these cases quickly. Within a couple of hours, you need to do the treatment, depending on how sludgy the blood is. If the blood is very, very sludgy, you need to do it within an hour. And if the anemia is very deep, then you have to give a transfusion within an hour.
So just how dangerous is the disease, TAPS?
Depends on a lot of factors. One of the factors is the gestational age at delivery. The more early the babies are delivered, the more complicated it becomes, because all these interventions, all these treatments are well, the younger and the smaller the baby becomes, the more complicated they become. It is especially dangerous. So if you are not prepared and don't know that it's there, and you are delivered in another hospital that doesn't have the expertise, and we know that
because you have to intervene quickly. Is there a time limit?
Yes, and because the interventions that we can do are something that if you're used to do it and you know what you're doing, then it's safe. But if it's in the hands of people who don't know about this disease, and that's why it's important to spread and to increase the awareness, then the people that don't know might not use the right intervention.
It was really quite serious at that point in time. They were 31 weeks, which is a good time. It's not a very risky time. It's not like the 24-week time where they think, but they still, because they had not gotten the correct nutrition inside and things like that, there was still a lot of risks associated with it. You always have to wash your hands and everything when you come into the neonatology unit. Otherwise, you can get infection. The babies can get infections. No, even something as simple as chickenpox. If you've been exposed to chickenpox, you can't go in there because the babies don't have immune systems. And it's quite traumatic, really, when you think about it. These poor little babies who should still be growing and developing, and there's so many risks involved.
After 2 days, the couple starts to tell people about their babies and that things are going okay. But it's not easy.
It was a really, really testing time because you have these two children who are critically ill in the intensive care unit. And people want to congratulate you and you kind of want to say, no, don't congratulate me yet. We've got a long road ahead.
And then there's a setback.
Right at the moment where they were moving Emily from the high care intensive care unit to they wanted to move her to a kind of medium care unit, and right at that moment all the alarms went off and it appeared she had some stage of infection, so that was really a scary moment.
Emily developed an infection and she was very ill from the infection, and they said this is one of the reasons why they're so strict about washing hands before you go into a NICU. It was a bacteria that lives on your skin, and it's just a very ordinary bacteria, but she got a bacterial infection. They had to give her another blood transfusion and they had to look after her. And this was actually the day that they were planning to move her to the high care unit instead of the intensive care unit. And she just went from being normal in the morning and she crashed. But then after a couple of days, both of them were well enough to move over to the high care unit, which was fantastic. And then Christmas Eve, we actually got a phone call from the LOMCA saying they're coming to Flavo Seeking House. And that was an amazing moment because they just said to us, you girls are going to be home for Christmas. It was just so wonderful that we were actually going to get them home because they'd been in the LOMCA for 12 days by this stage, and you know, it was just taking its toll with the travelling backwards and forwards.
And after the local hospital, the twins finally go home.
In the beginning it was a little bit scary as well because you knew they were in hospital, they were monitored 24/7 and you know, not much could happen there because there was always someone there. And
Matilda came home after 5 weeks, and Emily came home after 6 weeks. Emily still needed to grow a little bit because they have a policy that they don't release them until they're 2 kilograms. They have to be breathing on their own, they have to be drinking all their meals on their own, and they have to be over 2 kilograms. And with Emily, she was breathing fine, she was eating fine. The problem was she was 1.965 kilograms, so they put a finger on the weighing machine, and she came home.
Yeah, of course, we were we were prepared as best as we could. So we had these baby monitors with sensor pads underneath them, which monitor when they were breathing, and that was really a good thing because... Not so much because they still had these breathing incidents, but because it put us at ease and helped us sleep better because we knew something was watching them.
Now, 3 years later, Stephanie and Marius are enjoying family life.
Baby plants.
So how are the twins doing?
Really well, yeah. It's as standard with any premature birth. They have some delays in some areas, but in relation to it, they're both happy, healthy three-year-olds. So they go to the LOMSA regularly for testing, just to check their development and their growth and their brain development, those sort of things. So they're doing fine, yeah. No big concerns.
The Leiden University Medical Center discovered the disease twin anemia polycythemia sequence, TAPS, a variant of TTTS, twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome. And as such, it's the world's leading center on developing treatment for TAPS and dealing with the effects. I asked Dr. Lopriore if Stephanie hadn't been treated in Leiden, whether her twins would have survived.
That's a very difficult question. It's impossible to answer. It depends. Because she was under investigations in our hospital, we knew what was going on and we knew when to deliver and how to... I have no idea how it could have gone wrong. It could certainly have gone wrong, but it's what if it's something that I prefer not to go into. You never know how things go in life.
Okay, but you know for sure you've helped an awful lot of women in Stephanie's situation.
Yes, that's. I'm certain that what we did, she was delivered in a place where the maximum expertise was, and we're doing things now with the best of our knowledge. I'm also convinced that in 10 years or 20 years of time, they will look back and say, what on earth were you thinking and what were you doing? But at the moment, we think we are we're doing the things at the best of our knowledge. But again, it's very important to realize that this is work in progress and that we should never sit down and relax, that we need to work on it and find out whether these... The criteria, whether the diagnostic tests that we're doing are right. Maybe we should do it much more often. Maybe the treatment that we're doing is not the right one. So we need to really keep the pressure on and never think that we're there yet. And I'm convinced that there are this is one disease in monochorionic twins, but there are more diseases out there that need to be, well, discovered and fine-tuned and find the best treatment. We're very often think that we have all these books full of knowledge and that it's all there and that we think we know it all, but we should be more humble and realize that I'm certain that there is a lot of space for improvement.
And Stephanie, what does she think when she looks back on it all?
I wonder how I retained my sanity. I really honestly do, because when I look back in some of the things that happened, and there's such an emotional ups and downs and milestones and setbacks, and I think, you know, I really kind of get to the point where I'm like, how did I keep it all together? That was the first thought. But then but now I look back and I think, wow, it's such a strengthening experience. It showed me, you know, you can't always be a control freak about things, because I'm a grade A control freak, you know. I had post-it notes everywhere, I had lists written, I had an agenda that was synced to the calendar, that was synced to the Google calendar, and, you know, but now it's kind of like, okay, if it's not on the calendar on the wall, it's doesn't happen, and that's the rule in the house. But it taught me that I can't control every situation. And sometimes something is going to be dealt to you that you just can't control, and you have to ride it out. If it goes badly or if it goes well, you can't control it.
Stephanie reflecting on the amazing story of her road to having her twins, Emily and Matilda. I hope you enjoyed this Longer Here in Holland special. Please get in touch and let me know what you think. There's an email, hereinholland@gmail.com. There's Facebook, facebook.com/podcast here in Holland. There's a WhatsApp number I'll put in the show notes too. and please spread the word about Here in Holland and subscribe via iTunes or your Android app of choice to get all editions if you haven't done so already. And just in case you haven't had enough of Stephanie's great anecdotes, here's a special bonus story. Starving after the birth of her twins, she was looking forward to dinner in her hospital ward.
So, I had literally been out of surgery for 3 hours, and I'd been on a fast from midnight the night before, so I hadn't eaten a thing all day. And I was lying in the hospital bed, I could hear the meal trolley coming around, I could smell the food, and I was just thinking, bring me the food. I don't care what it is. You know, hospital food has the terrible reputation, but I'm so hungry, I could eat anything right now. And so I'm lying there in the bed and I can hear the trolley coming closer and I'm thinking, great. Anyway, this guy walks into my room in a hospital uniform and I'm thinking, oh, fantastic. He's got a tray, it's covered, dinner's ready kind of thing. So sort of shuffled up the bed. I was still under the anesthetic, so he shuffled up the bed, kind of not quite clear in the head, and he wheels the tray over and he puts it on the thing and he lifts the lid off and he says, in the typical Dutch fashion, you know, gives his hand over and says, hi, I'm Dr. Lapriore, and I brought your placenta for you. And I went, yes, you did. And so he kind of explains, and he's very excited because, like, it's a case of classic TAPS, which is what he's researching, and it was dyed all pretty colours. And he was saying the red and blue part is for Emily, the green and gold part is for Matilda, and you know, this is the connections, and you know, I'd really like to take it away and look at it under a microscope. And I'm kind of at this point in time going, is this my dinner? You know, I'm so upset, like, this was my dinner. And I said to him, sure, take it, it's yours, you know, just get it away from me. And he's like, no, you don't understand, I need you to sign a paper. And I said, that's fine, have you got a pen? And so he gives me this pen, and he literally, I've never seen anyone more excited. He put the lid on, he skipped out of the room, and he was like, I could literally hear him going, you know, my precious, in his mind. And as he walks out of the room, and I'm kind of like, I thought that was my dinner. And I'm sort of like, but the poor guy who came in like literally 5 minutes later with the dinner tray really must have been shocked when I said to him, you know, can you just take the lid off over there and bring it to me? But yeah, so that was my first actual live encounter with Dr. Lapriore.
From me, Andy Clark, thanks for listening. The show notes do have some resources on TTTS and TAPS should you want to know more about these rare conditions. So until the next time, and thanks again for listening.